session number 25180, reel 2.
So we're talking about when you would have been made a gunner while 1940, what do you recall of the progress that the war was taking?
Well, in those early years, in those years of 40, where it was very, very disturbing for everyone, and particularly from no less than the RAF command, which were very short of course, this war started, they had any of those old Hurricanes and things to fight with, and and Britain had, Germans had the air supremacy, and it was, I can always remember the we were sent on the first 2,000 bomber raids from, in those days, they had supremacy of the air. It was pretty, it was only later in that everything got on. When I came back from Egypt at the end of 43.
Well, we'll talk about that, but what do you recall, for instance, in the middle of 1940 with the German blitzing through Western Europe? Dunkirk.
Well, it was all very terrifying. I think everybody was of concern. When we first went to England, they were bombing England. I remember bombing raids in England. I went on leave with Bristol, and we were caught right in the middle of the night there with a bombing raid. And the street was just, we got out all right, but the street was just, Bristol was just, mainly where we were living was piled with rocks. And when we tried to get home, I remember shrapnel from our own anti-aircraft gun were whizzing and metal going down the streets. It was a terrifying situation. And poor old Britain was everyone wondered where the next turn was.
You mentioned, obviously, that there was a bit of concern that you might actually miss out on the war.
Oh, that was in the waiting for.
But at this time, was there ever a time when you thought you might not only just miss out on the war, but you might be on the losing side? Was there ever a time
John, every chap in those days would not like to talk about the we went back to the mess of the night, and you didn't speculate on that one. It was very, very frightening, the just where things were going in 40.
You mentioned that you obviously joined up for loyalty reasons mainly. Were you prepared to die for king and country?
Well, I think that's a question. The chap on bomber command was you had no option. Every operation you went on, you didn't know when you'd come back, if you would.
What about the idea of killing the king and country?
Well, that sort of took a depressing thoughts on that. Gee, I'm pouring out secrets now, but yet, coming back on a raid from Germany, when they read in the paper where you probably killed so many 100,000 people in Cologne or somewhere, and then that it also put underneath with that we would have certainly wounded how many hundreds of thousands of civilians and women and kids, didn't make you feel very proud of what you were doing. But then you never saw it because you're up 18,000 feet in the air, and the in the middle of the night and then flak at you all the time, you were pretty exhausted after 5 hours of down the river. And or in Egypt when we were sent, there was a relief because we were at least fighting men, not women and kids. But that feeling when you're tired and exhausted, and I feel that you though you had the feelings of a bit of depression, that you what the hell are you doing here? But you had to just take that.
But early on, did that ever cross your mind?
Oh, well, that was always there. That's what you joined up for, to fly. You do what you're told. You didn't question it.
So let's talk
about... I don't think any of us questioned it. I don't remember questioning it with the chaps. It was something we were doing. And you wouldn't show your fear. What's the point of it? You were there to do as you're told. I think any airman would agree with that.
What about then the situation?
Because your friends were getting knocked off.
Well, we'll talk about that later. Yeah. We're talking, if we can, about the early periods of training and the thought possibly that there was a degree of naivety going on within you. You didn't really know what you were in for.
No. You had that as a blind future. And the only thing they first said, well, learn how to use a gun or use your abilities to make sure you were minimized your risk. So you conscientiously made sure you, when you went on leave, you didn't play up too hard, that you kept fit. That was your best chance of survival. Well, it actually, personally, was just flaming sheer luck, but I think a lot of anyone honest would have said so. You're damn lucky to get out, which I was. But I'm a lucky one to be. But why should we get hit first? And the crew we were, the rest of them were four blokes we never heard of again. They were killed, and I got out of it. Mm. You know, that's nothing but sheer blind luck. And fortunately, I was one that I think so. You had that feeling of up to then train yourself and keep fit, and then of course you react sometimes and wouldn't. You get all a little depressed and beat up a few beers a bit in London or something. But you follow the atmosphere. I'm trying to give you the atmosphere.
Yeah, no.
I don't know whether I'm talking too much of this thing or not.
You're doing very well. I'm interested in relation to the training. What did that actually involve then, being a gunner wireless operator?
Well, we went through the different stages with air gunnery, air to air, and so on, with Brownings, and... which I hated the bloody... I was really disappointed about that one. However, well, we're in it, and that was it. But I accepted it, and I found it very hard to accept. But when that was done, then, of course, you had all your recognition of German aircraft or spotting aircraft. You had your accuracies and that way. So it was all in pretty involved. You wanted to keep... best of things, and I do say you had to keep fit. This all was your best chance anyway, and then you had to, the rest of it was blind luck, as I was doing. It was, you could be efficient as you like, but there's no reason you could. Lots of blokes were efficient, but they still stopped them flacking the guts or shell, or you got shot down or something. That's part of the luck of the game, and the odds weren't terribly good then, of course. And yeah, there was we were in statistics the more as second in casualties to submarines in the last war. That's the statistics of it. But I think we're all talking personal on this, and I think you're. You weren't on your own, of course. You had your friends with you. And we all had to accept the same risk. We all knew the risk was there, but it was a case of how you reacted under the risk. Some could think under the risk and some couldn't. They get had reasons, but some could think under stress. And I think that sums it up in a personal way.
So the planes that you were to practice on in Australia, what did they include?
Oh, we had our ferry battles, but we only did 3 weeks and we were set to England, and then we did gunnery there. But when we got to the end of England, we went straight into operational training units.
Well, let's talk about the trip then. Finally leaving Australia. Here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Only actually about a year after you joined up, I understand, or less. You're off. What was the feeling?
Oh, didn't know where we were going until we got on a ship. We weren't told at embarkation.
But what was it like to know that you were leaving Australia, heading off?
Presumably. Oh, well, here we are. We're in for the haul. We were glad we were leaving Australia. We didn't want to stop here. We felt sorry for the fellows that were left instructing out of Canada or somewhere. We were going to get into the real stuff.
Did you in any way sort of feel like part of a mob, part of a group of sheep being herded about? Is there that sort of sense?
Well, I think you... I think from the lonely station's life or the you get into... You didn't accept very easily living as in a mob. You lost your name as soon as you joined initial training. You were, my number is 407486, and that's what I lived under. You were just an individual in the mob, and you got a little bit critical of the. but probably. Without good reason, but still, living in a mob takes some doing. There's not much personal privacy in a low rank.
Mm.
Living in hundreds of men.
Given your background.
some fellows took. Some fellows were. But fortunately, I was grateful I'd been at boarding school, and I went to boarding school as a young boy.
What sort of propaganda had you been up against, had you experienced?
I didn't take any... You ask a question I really had never given really a lot of thought to. But we didn't. I didn't take the propaganda. I just accepted as it should be accepted, as far as I was concerned. Let some other person believe it, but I wasn't. I wouldn't be joining in that propaganda.
And how were the Germans seen then? Really? How were the Germans seen then as a fighting force, as a soldier? As an enemy, an opponent.
Well, we never saw them, really.
What was the feeling like, though? Did they play cricket? Was that the impression?
You or us. There was no halfway in an aeroplane with bloody flak all over you, and you just, every man for himself.
On leaving Australia, did you feel prepared? How prepared did you feel? Given the knowledge that you had of how the Germans were doing at this point, they had Panzer tanks there, Luftwaffe, pretty impressive.
I think we all, you would have treated them with a lot of respect. They were a very efficient, if we knew it, efficient fighting force. We had to meet them. That's what we're there for. But the morale of this place that I was in, it got a bit down a little bit at times, but we still all stuck together as a team. I think we were let's have a go at the bees, you know. I don't think I found any lack of them or us. You follow me? What else do you just no good say? Well, Pooh, you're there and you're in the uniform and you go, don't you? No good arguing about it. I think there's an atmosphere of.
You might never come back.
I can't find the word. No, we mightn't come back, but what else are you going to do? You can't walk out. You were committed. And you just had to take it.
Was that something difficult to accept?
No, it wasn't easy. But there's nothing you can do about it. You had to go. You went on your own, of course.
Well, tell us about the trip. What was it like on board ship?
Oh, well, we had a little bit of a unit, and it was the most extreme, terrific experience, really. They sent us to the first troops to go through America, and they put us in civilian clothes because America wasn't in the war, and they sent us over on this ocean runner that was coming from California to here. Bloody lovely ship, the Matson Line. And we were civilians. We were like living like lords. And they took us up to Canada and put us on a train, but non-stop, straight through to Halifax. And then we were given a quick gunnery course for a week in Halifax, and we were put on a destroyer on pom-pom guns. And we went over in a convoy we were on the port side. There was the stern, and one up the front and the starboard, and we had 72 ships convoy that went through. And we didn't know whether we were floating Air Force or what have you, but we were in action stations, which we were attacked over in submarines, and we were up on the pom-pom guns on this destroyer. But they issued us duffel coats and gear, and then we got off and then went, this little group of us, we went to ATU, and we finally got back in the Air Force when we got to England. But it was quite an experience. But I always remember that the attacks on that ship were really, really amazing.
Tell us about that experience, though.
Well, we were there were three watches, of course, the red, white, and blue, and we were. But when action stations, all were ordered onto the gun. Well, we would go up on the pom-pom guns, and they, of course, they couldn't go into the convoy because of the subs used to get up inside and start, and there'd be burning ships inside the convoy, and you couldn't shoot in there. But they used to swing the guns, 6-inch guns, had a 360-degree radius, and we were on pommel. Well, no, there's no one going to do that there, but they'd put the full throttle, and they go up and down the side of the convoy, full throttle, full bore. And of course, in the North Atlantic, the water's black as ink at night. It was the damn thing would go underneath. I wondered if it ever come up again. The water would, all the bow would go right under, and she would, and then they were dropping depth charges, they're trying to bring the subs up onto the surface, and if they did, they'd point them, it hit them, and so the guns were all going, and all the searchlights were connected with each gun, so the searchlights are going around too, the whole ship. And then at night it was quite a. If she goes in, we'll be. It's only three. You only live for 3 minutes in that icy water. But it was quite a. But you got very tired. We You only get 3 hours and you'd be back again on watch again. And the food was, tucker was just survival stuff really. And we found that 70% of the crew that we were living with, because we were sergeants, we had no rank on that thing at all, but we slept with them. We were just added to the to make up the numbers, and we were there. 75% of them were Scotties.
And so you fit in perfectly.
Oh, we loved the docks on it. That was good, and there was you didn't think on that ship.
What was the feeling like in that situation where you're so, having to deal with the raids at night? Here you are in a combat zone. You haven't even reached your destination yet.
How do we think?
You might never reach.
Well, as I say, we wondered what the hell we were doing. We were whether we were the floating air force or the flying navy or what we were doing. But we were just part of a system with these other chaps, and we did what you were told, and you just disciplined, I suppose, that was the answer. You can't say no. You just do what you're bloody told, and then learn to do it quickly. Those that, chaps that didn't were fools. When you're in the British Navy, I'll tell you, they don't worry about who you are. You just do what you're told. If you don't, well, you're a fool.
What was the general thought toward the higher command?
Well, I can offer you mine, and that is that I found that as a non-commissioned officer, I was later commissioned, but in the early part of it, I found the junior officers of RAF were terrible, pompous and terrible people. And the parachute section, pilot officer and those and sort of chaps. And to us, I had no respect for them at all. None at all. But but in contrast, the further up you went, I found the top boys were fantastic. And you get up to the top English officer in the RAF, the squadron leaders and those chaps, they were, I have highest respect for them. And they, right through operations and everything else, they were top men. And they were, and any problems I had, I used to go to the top and I found them excellent. And they were, never let me down. I said, sir, this is unjust, and I'd be berated. Because you all get in trouble sooner or later. But that was my overall assessment of the generalising, of course. They were, have my terrific experience, they were top men.
In relation to the situation, in relation to arriving in England, how were you greeted? Australian men from the Empire training scheme?
Oh, we were, they didn't, the RAF chaps didn't like us. We didn't like them and we didn't like, there was, we were very, didn't comply to their ideas of a subordinate sergeant. We took no notice of that. We weren't career people in the I wasn't, which was a mistake, I suppose. I didn't look for, I was there to, when the war was over, I couldn't get back home quick enough. I didn't want a career in the, I didn't like, want it at all. And I should have, it was a mistake on my part. But on the other hand, I found that there's a class area, but I know there's a farmer down at Streaky Bay, old Bill Thompson. He and I went on leave together, and I used to get a bale of wool over, and I kept a good account in the 11 Leadenhall Street with the Bank of Adelaide, and I used to get a few quid there. So we'd be comfortable on leave. And I remember we were asked to give, we'd allowed a drink in the officers' mess down at down in the south of England, in Gloucester. And we said, oh, we'll be comfortable for this weekend. So we've got two really nice rooms in the hotel. And we walked into the saloon bar to have a, you know, the, we were ordered out with any officers only. That was the beginning. We, Bill and I, didn't like this. But we were, that we found that, generally speaking, it was, we found the, we didn't accept, foolishly, we'd been a lot kinder on ourselves, we had accepted rank consciousness of the RAF.
I'm interested.
But on the squadrons, that was another story. When you got onto the squadron, that was, well, we were all there together then. There was our, we were all respected each other, you know, for what we were doing on the squadron. I'm talking about the day, living the daily life of the RAF training schools and so on. Gee, they were a bit hard to take. You know, of course we were, well, I don't take the blame on them. I take the blame a lot on us. We would have, should have been, I think, more conservative, put it that way. Accepted their rules.
Well, I get this impression that the...
Perhaps I shouldn't be saying this on this. You better delete some of all this.
I'm interested in the impression that the Australian soldier, the Australian airman, was always a bit sort of rough around the edges. It was always a bit...
Oh, yeah. We weren't professional. Anything but professional servicemen. That was the trouble. We were enlisted.
But, I mean, a lot of the Tommies were, too. And
oh, yeah.
I'm interested, though, that there is, I understand, this sort of general relaxed attitude that the Australians had towards hierarchy, towards class, towards
the job.
We did. Why did that exist, do you think?
Well, I find that a little hard to answer. I think the Australian chap was resented the discipline in the self. I think that may have been some of the country training of ours.
Given that you'd been a manager of a sheep station, you weren't just the average...
Yeah, I was under manager, actually.
Joe London.
I found that I don't really know. Of course, you're asking a question that's been asked 1,000 times for in the services of Australia, you know, how this atmosphere has been part of our individual independence, I think, that we live in Australia.
There's sort of a sense of humour that one took with them. Take everything too seriously.
That's right, yeah.